We are live. Welcome, folks, to episode 3813 of the Survival Podcast. I'm going to do something a little bit different right out of the gate today, because I know a lot of people find videos of my podcasts on YouTube, and that may be you. Probably not right now if you're live, but if you happen to find this in search and you're interested in the topic today, which is propagating plants from grocery store produce, you may not be looking for a podcast. You may be looking for something with a bunch of B-roll, AI-generated crap that makes you feel good about the idea, or somebody walking you through making a carrot root or something like that, because there's all kinds of videos like that. Today's going to be a little bit different. We're not going to be doing that. There'll be a lot of visual aids. Yes, it's one guy talking, but stick with me if that's you, because I think you'll really enjoy this. If you stick with me today and follow through with this podcast, when you're done, you won't just know how to regrow some stuff from the supermarket like these old 10-minute AI slot videos, right? You'll know how to propagate plants. All we're doing is taking real everyday plant propagation technology, things like rooting cuttings, making slips and other things like that, and we're applying them to vegetation that you happen to be able to acquire in the grocery store. And this might mean picking something up specifically to do it, or using a piece of it that you would otherwise discard to make more food. So this show is called the Survival Podcast. It's all about self-sufficiency, self-reliance, independence, and liberty in your own life. And so that's what we'll be digging into today. So if you're new to us and you found us, hey, subscribe. Hit the subscribe button and give us a thumbs up. That helps us reach more people. And if you are finding us on YouTube for the first time, realize we are a podcast that has been online for almost 18 years. And most of our subscribers are actually audio only. So go over to the website, thesurvivalpodcast.com. And check out all the ways to stay in touch with us. All right. With that, what are we talking about today? Yes, we are talking about growing plants using produce or produce waste from the grocery store. And I've been kind of planning to do this show for a long time. I do this a lot, and I do it a variety of ways. I'm going to go over a bunch of them today. But one of the reasons I decided to do this is, you know, we all are online. And we all see all the little short videos, the long videos, the associated videos, and things like that. And I've seen so many videos on this topic. It'll be somebody, look, I put a carrot in water, and it got the green leaves, and now I'm going to plant it, and it's a new carrot. And no, it's not. It doesn't mean it's not useful. But the way that video presents it, or the way that personality presents it, you'd think that, well, it's just going to grow a new carrot. Then you get another video and somebody who points out that that person does not know what the hell they're doing and then tells you just basically don't do it. It's a waste of time. And as I've watched that, I'm like, you know, both of these sides have a point, but nobody's actually teaching anybody how to do this usefully or what you should do and what you should just not waste your time with, depending on what the result would be and what you're looking for. So what we're going to do today is we're going to go through why you would even want to do this, other than like it could be a second grader's, you know, thing from school or something like that. And that's fine. But for most people, like, you're only going to want to do this if you get something out of it. Maybe it's a little project with your kids or whatever, but that's like a one off. What you actually learn how to do this, you actually create a whole new opportunity for yourself in a lot of ways that we'll discuss today. And we're also going to talk about the primary methods we can use to do this. Instead of saying, hey, did you know you can take a sweet potato and stick it in a fish tank and vines will grow out of it, then you can plant them in your garden, right? Okay, what is that called? What is that called? Hey, you can regrow the core of a celery plant. Yeah, if you know how to do it. Most of the people showing you how to do it don't know how to do it. That's your first clue. And what they end up with is a rotted base and no real celery. But there's a way to do it. But what's it called? You see, if you learn these methods of plant propagation, they apply to everything. If you can go into a grocery store, buy a little clamshell of fresh basil, use some of it, take a few pieces of it, root that, and put it into your garden, that means when there's basil growing in your garden of just about any basil variety, you can do the same thing and make more plants. You see how that works? And so if we start out with, let's not worry about how do we're going to talk about how to do it, but not how do we propagate green onion cuttings. What is it called? And what is that technique? And what does it do? And how does it work? And what should you do? And what should you not do? Well, then you can start looking around going, I can replicate that, and I can replicate that, and I can replicate that, and that's not worth it. So you'll be informed and empowered that way, which is what we try to do on this show all the time. And next, we're going to then talk about some specific things under each technique. So once we talk about something like rooting softwood cuttings, then we'll talk about some of the softwood cuttings that are commonly available in the grocery store and anything in particular about them that you need to know, or why in particular you would take that approach other than just, you know, growing it from seed, or, you know, cloning or buying a plant from a box store. Why would you bother to do this in the grocery store and instead with the grocery store produce rather than just go out and get the plants? Or why would you propagate something like basil when it's so easy to grow from seed? There's reasons. And so we're going to cover all of that stuff today and more. And just a real quick reminder for the old timers here that are in the live stream. And so you have an opportunity to communicate with each other in real time and with me in real time. If you have a question for me today, if you have a comment that you would like me to respond to, if you have anything like that, put the word question or comment or whatever in all caps. And if I see it, and I am blind in one eye, but if I do see it, I will hit a star button on it, and I'll come back to it at the end of the episode. Before we move on, let's go ahead and hear from our sponsor today. And the sponsor of the show today, number one, sponsor of the show today is me, myself, and I. I realize I don't talk about some of the things that we have available to you as much as I should. And one of those things is definitely the courses that I have put together for you at homefoodsystems.com. There's three courses you can take right now. There is a principle-based permaculture design course. If you like today's episode, you're going to love this course. It's completely free, 5 lessons with quizzes. It's also got a certificate at the end that says you've taken the course, all that stuff. It's free, so you can kick the tires and check it out. I also have one on bioreactor composting, which makes the best, most fertile, most active compost on the planet. That course is $40. And I have a course called Backyard Cover Crops and Soil Secrets. It's $80. And more than one person who has taken it that has also taken courses that are thousands of dollars has said they learned more in my $80 course than in those very expensive courses of practical, usable things in the backyard anyway. That's an $80 course. So you can find all of those at homefoodsystems.com. Homefoodsystems.com is our sponsor of the day today. With that, let's dig on into talking about this subject. So again, I want to start, why would we do this? I think a lot of people just think, well, it's free. Yeah, okay. A lot of things are free. I mean, they're good. And is it really free if I have to go to the grocery store and buy something, right? Especially if I'm buying it just for propagation. That really makes sense. So what I want to start off with is the number one thing we're able to do is turn something from a waste stream into something productive. Instead of recycling, we never dispose of. We reuse, right? It's reuse versus recycle. Something like that could be really simple, which would be I go to the store, I buy green onions, I cut the tip off, and instead of just throwing that little tip away, I make the tip a little bit bigger, and I plant it. And it could be that simple. But in either event, I've changed something that was a waste product, something normally would be discarded, into something useful. If I regrow the core of a celery plant, I'm going to tell you how to do that today. And I'm going to tell you how to do that where it actually produces something you can use. Normally, what people do is throw it away or maybe throw it in the pot to make vegetable stock out of it, right? So we're going to intercept that waste stream and turn it and use it before it becomes waste. It never becomes waste. Some things are hard to find or grow any other way. There's stuff that, like, if you want to propagate something like, or you want to grow something like Murasaki sweet potato, right? You're probably not going to find sweet potato slopes for that at your local garden store. Or you're definitely not going to find them at your big box store. I've never seen slips available at a box store. That's a little plant, rooted plant off of the potato that you plant and grows into a new plant, makes new potatoes for you. And if you order it in the mail, you're probably going to get crap. You're probably going to get absolutely dog shit crap out of it because they just don't travel well. They might make it, they might survive, but I've ordered a lot of sweet potato slips in my life when I've gotten behind. If you're like, I'll do this, and what I get looks like somebody stepped on it. So it's really hard to get that particular thing in a garden store or from a catalog or whatever and get it in usable format. But if you grow it, you can just go to any supermarket that sells organic produce and pick up a Murasaki potato, which is the purple skin, yellow flesh, and make slips. So some things are just hard to get. There's some tropical fruits you can grow and stuff like that. There's some, you know, odd varieties of this and that. If you happen to buy something from your local market and you really like it, you're not really sure what it is. If you can propagate it one way or another, you know it's the same thing. And we'll talk a little bit about hybrids and everybody's fear of that here a bit later today when we get into seed-based reproduction. It's also be much more rapid reproduction in some instances. I mean, if you go to a grocery store and you know how to root cuttings and you get something like a small basil, like live basil plant there, and you can make cuttings out of it, you could have 20 plants ready to go out into your garden in less than 2 weeks that will be already substantially sized. If you plant basil seed in those 10 pots in 2 weeks, you have little bitty, very fragile seedlings that are probably not ready to go out into the garden yet. So you can speed everything up. And that's another piece of it. And then bluntly, it could just be fun. How cool is it that you can basically, like, especially like if you're an aquaponics guy like me and you've got ebb and flow beds, you can start popping stuff in from the grocery store. All of a sudden, food starts coming out of it. It was all garbage. So it's just fun. And that's why it is a thing. That's why all those videos I was picking on a little bit at the beginning exist, because people like to do things that are fun. This is fun to do. And propagation is propagation. That's why I'm teaching it the way I am today. I'm saying, just look at the roots on the bottom of this piece of cell. Like, so what? How many people are going to do that, right? But if you know how to propagate plants, if you understand what you're doing, then you can do it over and over and over again. And my personal opinion is that plant propagation is the closest thing to printing money that will not send you to jail. I mean, think about it from this standpoint. I remember not that long ago, buying plants to put in your garden wasn't that bad. You could go buy, you know, your common vegetable varieties, herbs, and all the other stuff for about $2 to $3 a plant for about a 4-inch round potted plant from like Bonnie's or something like that. Walmart, Home Depot, Lowe's, whatever. And if you went to like your small, you know, regional garden shops and nurseries and stuff to do their own propagation, you could buy plants like that for about 75 cents. And so it wasn't that expensive if you had a small garden with a few beds in it to go out and buy your plants if you didn't feel like doing your own. What's it cost now? I don't even know because I haven't looked. I don't even know if the plants are out yet at the box stores, even out here in Texas. But last year I was seeing plants sell for $6 and up per plant. And they didn't even look that good. So if I could make 10 plants from the waste stream of $2 worth of basil from Albertsons, I just conjured, what, $60 out of thin air? Now, I don't think that's a directly true thing, because most people wouldn't go buy 10 basil plants. And most people aren't buying these plants now anyway, because they're just way out. It's just way out of proportion. This has nothing to do with tariffs or any of that bullshit, or you hate the orange man because prices went up, or you hate the previous White House guy who had a potato salad for a brain. It's not his fault. There is no excuse for this. When COVID hit, everybody decided to get into gardening. All these companies jacked up their prices collectively. And then if you don't stop buying them, they're going to keep charging that ridiculous price. And why wouldn't they? And if they sell half the plants for three times the cost, they make more money anyway. And they don't care that they wasted all the ones that die that don't get taken care of. So there is a monetary gain by learning how to propagate plants. And it allows you, once you know how to do this, to apply it to things that maybe you can't get in a grocery store. And that way, when you do go buy that one tomato plant, it turns out to be a fantastic tomato. You can make 20 plants out of your own plant during the season, where if you tried to get seed for it and start it mid-season, you would never get it up to size to produce for you. So hopefully that gives you the why. Now, let's talk about the one thing you need to know about doing this when it comes to produce from the grocery store. Sometimes it's really, really useful that the starter plant that you get your hands on is organic. And sometimes it doesn't matter at all. And sometimes it's almost mandatory depending on the supplier, which you don't really know if that's the case or not. So here's what I mean by that. if it is a product that often will sprout in the pantry or in the refrigerator, many things like potato and especially sweet potato and things like that, the producer, not only the producer, the processor and the wholesaler somewhere along the way in the chain on the way to you will sometimes spray something called a retardant on that thing. Don't get upset by the R word, and here especially, because it's what it's called. It's a retardant. And by the way, I say retard all the time anyway for you new people. But anyway, it's a retardant. So what that means is it's designed to inhibit the sprouting of that thing so it will have a longer shelf life. So with a sweet potato, I've never found a sweet potato that if properly treated wouldn't sprout anyway. But when I've taken like a purple sweet potato that is conventional and a purple sweet potato that is organic, and I put them side by side, one definitely produces sprouts faster, more aggressively, and generally speaking, I get more total production out of that one tuber of about the same size. So in some cases, that really matters. In some cases, it doesn't. It doesn't matter at all. And the reason it doesn't matter is because nobody does it. So we're going to talk about things today like rooting basil. This doesn't matter. I don't care if it was organically grown or whatever. You're growing a whole new plant out of one little piece of it. I don't care what it was sprayed with, and nobody puts a retardant on basil because nobody's worried about it sprouting. Just so you know that. Okay. Now, let's move on to the primary methods we're going to use. The number one method is the least often shown method in these, you know, funny little videos or whatever, these quirky little videos, these little viral videos, whatever you want to call them. And that's rooting softwoods. And you can do this with both annuals and perennials. And there is almost no plant that can't be rooted, but some are way easier than others. And we'll talk about some of the easiest there. But when I say softwoods, there is a point I'm trying to make. If you took a live basil plant, and you took like that one little stem that goes to a single leaf off of it, and it's just like that little thin stem, and you pulled that off and tried to root it, it's not going to work. Okay. And if you took like a very young shoot that's really floppy still, it's also going to be unlikely to work. And if you've ever seen a mature basil plant where it almost looks like a tree, like it gets a bark on it on the thick stuff, you can root that, but it's harder, it takes more time, and it has a different process than what we're talking about today, because I don't know of any hardwoods you would root from a store, so we're going to stick to softwoods. A hardwood is like a stick. A softwood is green, but when you bend it, it kind of cracks like a drinking straw, like a plastic straw. It kind of kinks. If it'll do that, it's a softwood. And so your main stems from a basil, for instance, would be something that you would do rooting of softwoods with. And this can be, there's a lot of different ways to do this. Let's say it's mint. You break it off and stick it in water, it roots. I looked at mint one time seductively and a root popped out of it. Like it's super easy. You get something like basil, it needs a little more attention. Right? And then some things might even require some different technology to get to root. Like when you start rooting some things, you need a process called intermittent mist that we're not going to get into today, but it's basically this little mist that goes off every minute and it keeps the humidity up, or you need a humidity dump. I want to keep this simple. The easiest way to root something that is a softwood cutting is simply to put it in water and then to give it reasonable light, but not heavy light, like a window is all you need for this. The plant at that stage is putting all its effort and energy into putting roots out to try to survive. You've basically cut off an arm and said, grow a body is kind of what's going on there. So you don't need heavy light. In fact, subdued light is kind of what you need until that plant starts to root, and then it can get a little bit more light and get potted out or set out. And I'm going to tell you that in most instances, when you root plants like we're talking about today, you're better off, once they're rooted, putting them into a pot, let that root establish, that regrowth begin, then harden it off and set it into your garden. Don't just take that little rooted cutting and stick it in the garden unless it's a perfect time of year and everything's just perfect out there and it's a little bit of shade and it's not too hot yet, because it's going to die. It has to readapt itself to the soil after this process. That's the easy. Now, the way that you can make this more effective is every day, take the container your cuttings are in, take them out, dump the water out, replace it, and stick them back in there. Why does that work? Well, people say, well, the stems rot sometimes if you don't do that. The water gets nasty, whatever. But why? The one-word answer. And you need it to survive. If you don't have it for a few minutes even, you're going to die. Oxygen. So when you put water into a jar out of a faucet, there's oxygen in that water, not the bonded oxygen to the hydrant. There's air in all water pretty much, unless you did something to prevent it. And when you put it in there and it's disturbed, that creates more oxygen dissolved in the water. We're talking about dissolved O2 levels here, not H2O, right? And that keeps the stock clean and able to function. It doesn't get all scummy. It doesn't go anaerobic, and that way it can root, and you get nice white roots. If you get roots on anything you're trying to root, or even a plant that you're growing like an aquaponics or hydroponics, you look at the roots and they're discolored, that's unhappy. Nice bright roots, generally that means you got good oxygen levels. So that does that. So how else can we do that? One, if you know what ebb and flow tech is in aquaponics or hydroponics, where you have a pump and you have a bed and the water comes up, and the water goes back down. That's all I'm going to say about it today. We're not going to do an aquaponics show today. A lot of cuttings can just go into an ebb and flow bed, an aquaponics bed. And as long as it doesn't get, like if you're, it's an outdoor system, you might put a little shade over it or something like that. So it's not too intense. It'll just root. Things that normally wouldn't will. Basil roots like basil in an ebb and flow bed roots almost as aggressively as mint in just plain water. That's how easy basil becomes there. All right. Now, how else could we do this? Because not all of you are going to go out there and put in a big old aquaponic system like I have several of. So another way is you just need oxygen. A simple Tupperware box, and I'm going to build one of these and make a video out of it for you, but you don't have to wait on me. You can find tons of these. A simple, like a clear Sterilite box, kind of shallow is better because it's less sloshy to move around. Fill it up. Put some holes in the top. So you stick your plants through. Now you got the plant above water and the stalk below the water. Then take a fish tank air pump. And I mean, you can use like a cheapo, super cheap Tetra Whisper is probably the best one to use because they're quiet and they're less than $20. Get a long air stone, about a 6-inch long air stone. You can get this at Petco, PetSmart, pet section of the department store, Amazon, wherever you want. And hook that with a tube to that and plug it in and put your plants in there. Your rooting rates will go up like crazy. Total cost, $25. Airstone box, all you probably have some of the shit around anyway. Or get a small pump, like a water pump, like a pump for a little fountain, but a tiny one. For like when you want to look on Amazon, look for a nano fish tank pump. Most of them have suction cups. Suction cup it to the side corner pointing the long dimension on your box. So your box, for those on audio like this, your box is here. I'm saying like right here, and point it that way so that it creates a cyclone effect. So the water's moving. That means it's going to have oxygen in it. Either of those methods will work. If you're trying to root things that are being finicky and having some problems, I recommend a little bit of root hormone. And I have a product we had Nick Ferguson on last week. He was talking about like, if you use the liquid concentrate, you can dial in your percentages and all. And I totally agree. I totally agree from a standpoint of if you are doing a lot of propagation. If you are making a few cuttings of this and a few cuttings of that and you just want some insurance, the product I'm going to put on your screen right now is about $8. It's called Root Boost. It is a powdered formula. You should still wear like nitrile gloves or something like that when you're using this. It's not something you want in your skin. It's much less likely to get places you don't intend it to as a powder. All you do is take the plant you want to root and just put it in the bottle and get a little tiny bit of powder on it and set it down somewhere and let it sit for about a minute before you stick it in the water. Your rooting success will go up tremendously. And again, that's a $7 product. If you want to make sure you find the right product, you can go by the show notes after this live stream is over. There's a link down there in the video notes. And if you get over to the episode, just go to the Survival Podcast and look for this episode. There's a link to that and other things available for you in today's episode for all the resources. But that's how you root softwoods, and that's the most complicated thing we're going to really talk about today. The other stuff is just kind of dialing it in to work with the grocery store. But that actually is going to open up way more to you than most of these little videos do. Because now when you go in there and you're like, my wife told me to pick up some fresh thyme, right? I need some fresh thyme. I don't have enough thyme on my hands, right? So if it's an herb, you know, thyme. And she didn't want the dried shit in the jar or whatever. And you go buy the little clamshell because they don't have the big bundles of stuff out yet. And you got the little clamshell. It's about this big. Costs about $2. And you take it home and you know she's going to use like, you know, 2 sprigs out of it. You're going to have like 4 more sprigs of this. Would it be great if you just had thyme on your hands all the time, right? Yeah, I'm playing with that a little bit. Well, if you take all the cuttings that will work off of that, and you root those, now you have 5 thyme plants. So now you have 5 times as much thyme. Isn't that cool? So most of these videos aren't going to teach you what I just did. That's what I'm getting at. When you understand how to root cuttings, and thyme is not hard to root, but you'll have a lot more successful times of rooting thyme if you use a little bit of rooting hormone, and especially if you use either a rooting box or an ebb and flow bed to go with it. All right. Then let's talk about regrowing cores. This is the one that, you know, most people are familiar with, like things like celery, and you see the video and the person takes and they take the core and they put it in some water and they change the water every day and some little fresh leaves grow out of it and they keep changing the water and then some roots and then they plant it. And then the video ends and they say, yay, new celery. And then, you know, Debbie Downer comes along and she's like, yeah, but that doesn't really work because all those big stalks will never regrow. And all you're going to get is a little bit of growth out of it. And it's not really like celery. And then the whole thing's going to rot and it's going to die. And she's right. Debbie Downer's right. So why am I telling you to do it? Because there's a right way and a wrong way to regrow a core of a plant that grows as a layered plant, like a celery or like a romaine lettuce. And that is, you do not cut it off. You don't cut it off. You take and you pull the outer leaves off until you get down to the heart and you leave the whole of the core. And then you take the approach of rooting it in some way and planting it. And then when you harvest from it, you harvest from the outside so that the middle keeps growing and becoming the new outside. What happens when you whack it? You know, you whack the bottom off that celery, that lettuce, that cabbage, and you stick it in the ground. Exactly what Debbie Downer says happens. The center grows, and then all that outer stuff just doesn't regrow. It's just not how it works. And so it starts to rot, and as it rots, it deteriorates. It goes anaerobic, and the living core now dies. And yeah, you get a couple little sprigs of celery, and you rotted core. And it was a fun second grade science experiment. But it didn't produce anything useful. If you pull from the outside, so when we buy celery, for instance, I always make plants out of my celery. I don't like, and this is another reason, I don't like starting celery from seed. It's a pain in the ass. They're tiny, germination rates are low, the seedlings are fiddly little pains in the ass. I prefer to have celery grow and grow and grow until the stalk comes up and it's going to go to seed and I let it go. And then it drops 1,000 seeds and some of them grow on their own. And that all comes from grocery store celery. So if when I'm doing that, I will pull all the way down until there's about 3 of those little beautiful stalks left and as much of that base core as possible. And then I'll root that. That can be easily rooted ebb and flow bed. A rooting box will work really well or straight into water. Like they tell you on the little science videos, just make sure you start with that. A lot of times, even going in my ebb and flow bed, I'll have the core. I'm in my kitchen doing cooking or something, and I'll get a glass, I'll put about 1 inch of water in, I'll stick it in that, and I'll set it on the counter. Just the ambient light from the kitchen and the ambient light from the windows on the one side of the kitchen. That's all it gets. And I'll, the next morning, dump the water out, put it back in, add water back to it. When it turns dark green, because that center core is going to be very white, it's stressed, it's the baby, right? When it turns dark green, then it goes out to the ebb and flow bed. It will root much faster and start to regrow. Once it puts roots on, it can go out to the garden or it can go into a pot and get a little bit more established before it goes into the garden. Very, very simple. Okay. So that's how you regrow cores. And that's anything with a core that is regrowable. That is the process. Stop cutting it, pull away from the outside, leave the center leaves. So they become the new mature leaves. And then the new leaves grow in the inside of the core, the way the plant's designed to grow. Of course, if you lob it off and stick it in there, it's not going to regrow properly. Then there's like what I would call growing secondary product. So here's another example of these videos. You know, anything is possible. Joe comes on and says, look what we can do. And he goes and he gets a carrot and he cuts the top off the carrot and he sticks it in water and it starts to get kind of some new growth on the surface. And he puts it in some dirt. He goes, and like 2 weeks later, look how much top growth there is. Now you have a new carrot you can plant in your garden. And Debbie Downer comes on and goes, it'll never work. He's an idiot. When you plant that in your garden, it's never going to be another carrot. Eventually, it's going to go to seed, and it won't ever produce another carrot. And both of them are right, sort of, again. Okay? The guy that made the video, he's right in a way. I've seen people do this for the purpose of what will come out of it, and they get like this deformed-looking weird carrot thing, and it's not a lot, but it's more than you started with, and you paid nothing for it, and it was no work. Okay, fine. But it will never be a carrot. A couple things. One, leave a little more than you normally would when you cut the part of the carrot you're going to eat off. Leave a half inch to an inch up there, and you'll get a little more of that bottom growth. But that's not what we're growing. We are growing carrot tops. Most of you think when I say carrot top, a weird comedian or a little kid with red hair or something like that, right? Carrot top, I mean the part of the carrot you see above the ground. Do you know they're delicious? They're kind of like a sweet version of a parsley. They're excellent chopped up in salads. They're good in sautés, all kinds of things. Like right at the end, like use them like fresh herbs. That's what you're growing. And the reason you don't know how good they are is, one, we're fucking spoiled in 2020, whatever it is, right? It doesn't matter. We've been spoiled for 50 years. Most people have never seen a carrot in the ground in their life. They don't know what one looks like. And most people have never even seen a carrot green. They buy a little friggin' baby ass, you know, they go on a lathe basically and whittle them down to the uniform carrots, or they buy them chopped up, or they buy a bunch of carrots with the greens cut right off them. If you do happen to get carrots with green on them, they look like shit. They're wilty and they're sad because they've been out of the ground for 4 months or whatever in the cold storage. So they don't seem worth doing anything with. They're fantastic. And most of you who grow carrots know what I'm talking about because you figured that out. You know what they make really good? Pesto. Carrot green pesto is awesome. Just the same way you make regular pesto. So there's certain things that we can regrow, but we're not really growing them for the original product we bought. We're creating a secondary product. Okay. And then there is creating clones and slips. Now, technically, when we root a softwood, we are cloning, but I mean this a little bit differently. This is usually done from tubers. And so this is where we take one tuber and instead of planting the tuber, we cause the tuber to sprout. And it's kind of two things in one. It's growing from a mother tuber, but then we're taking the top growth off and we're rooting it. Classic is the sweet potato, right? We take the sweet potato, we put it in I'll explain it better when we talk about sweet potatoes in a minute. I have a whole show on sweet potatoes. Just go to the survivalpodcast.com and put in sweet potato. You'll learn all kinds of, like 2 hours on sweet potatoes, right? But when that new growth comes up, we pull it off the tuber, we root it, and we plant it so that one tuber can make 20, 30, 40, in an ideal situation, 50 or even more plants can come off of one tuber. We can also do this with ginger and some other things, so I'll talk about that when we get into the individual plants. And then we have directly planting. Directly planting is we just take the thing like it comes and stick it in the ground and it grows. Or maybe we take the thing like it comes and cut into four pieces and put those four pieces in the ground and they grow. Okay? Potatoes, Jerusalem artichokes, ginger, things like that. Yeah? And then we have from seed. And this is often more useful than people believe it to be. And this goes back to a few things. First, it goes back to some of the things that you can find in a specialty market, especially if you go to like a central market or a Whole Foods, can be kind of difficult to find seed for. You find some really interesting stuff, especially when you're looking at tropical fruits and things like that, many of which can be grown as an annual if you start it early enough, or like in a pot that you bring in and out for winter. A lot of that stuff's difficult to find, but really easy to propagate from seed. Papaya is one of those things. Like there, you can do that with papaya. You can grow papaya as a house plant, basically, and keep it out in the time of year that it's happy, and some other things. There's some things you can't do that with because they need to be a full-on tree like a mango. So it's useful from that standpoint. You know, you might find some really interesting melon or something like that. And if you went to Baker Creek, you could find that melon, for instance. There'd be one seed supplier that would be likely to have it. But that's going to be a packet of seeds is $5. There's going to be like 20 seeds in there because it's rare, right? And you're gonna pay like $5 in shipping, and that's the only thing you wanted because you just found it. And now it's June, and you just found this melon at the market, and you just paid $10 with shipping included for some seeds. Then you get 20 seeds, and you're going to plant them. And then, well, oops, because now it's going to be winter before you get any melons. So you have to save them until next year. Or you like, I need to put that on my list for next year, and then you forget. Or you could just propagate those seeds right away and spend no money on them. And if they don't make it by the end of the season, you still have seeds left over because there's probably 100 seeds in that melon. So there's also things like you might find some peppers or some tomatoes that are really cool. And you're like, I want to try to propagate these. Go ahead. It doesn't cost anything. And I'm not going to tell you how to plant seeds, but I'm going to talk a little bit about how to harvest seeds. So this is more like a seed saving technique. And this stuff will work for your garden. But I'm going to save that till we go through some of the individual things that make sense to start from seed from the market, right? So we'll get to that as we go through. So those are all the ways and all the common things that cause problems for people when they're trying to plant seeds. So what can we propagate based on each technique then? Let's go through some of the top things that you can find in grocery stores that will work for each technique. Starting off with rooting softwoods. Again, any of the fresh herbs that they have in produce sections now, whether they're like the ones that are like in a bouquet type arrangement, even though it's like basil or something else, right? Or the little clamshells, as long as they're alive. And alive is subjective. So recently, and I gave it no rooting hormone, no special treatment, just shoved two pieces of it in an ebb and flow bed, and now they have new top growth and nice roots, basil. It was in a clamshell. It's one of my update videos on my propagation system out in the garage for the winter. And it was exactly what I said earlier about your wife wanting thyme, right? My wife needed some basil for something. I went and got the basil. She used maybe half of what was in the clamshell. The clamshell got knocked to the back of the refrigerator. I'm cleaning out the refrigerator. It's been back there at least 2 weeks. It looks like hell. I get two pieces out of it that seem viable, and they both worked. So alive is subjective, but if it doesn't work, it was probably too far gone, right? If it's crispy, it ain't happening, okay? If you take the leaves and do that with them and they crunch and they turn to dust, that's definitely too far. But basil is a super easy one to do. It's a great first one to do. Mint, super easy. I see a lot less fresh mint in stores, though. But mint is good to know anyway, that if you're ever somewhere and you see a mint, that nobody's going to be upset at you taking a little piece of it. You've got a good few hours unless it's baking in the sun. You know, keep the bottom damp somehow. Like if you get some little paper you can wrap around that's just wet and then keep it shaded. You've got until you get home and just drop it in water. It doesn't need any of the other stuff we talked about today. It will root. Thyme is a little harder than basil to root, but not much. It will definitely ebb and flow bed, rooting box, or aided by a little bit of hormone, that powdered hormone I showed you, and change the water every day. And you'll have no trouble rooting thyme. And thyme is an incredibly, I mean, for all the jokes I did about thyme, to have thyme, right, it is an incredibly versatile herb. And once it is established, it is freaking bulletproof. It is tough. It is a weed that we like to eat, is a way to think of it. Parsley. Parsley can be tricky. And most of the time when you buy parsley, you're going to buy like a bunch of parsley. That what they did was they they just cut the top of the plant off and bundled it. And what you're looking for is a good thick base, and you want to come up to where like your first leaves are and cut everything above that off and then root that base. And it's probably the hardest one out of the ones I've got listed for you today. Oh, on another note, when you're rooting any kind of a softwood cutting, you want to minimize how – I know you want lots of leaves. No, you don't. Like, so a basil plant, you want maybe four leaves on it. And if two of those leaves are like the big leaves, take a pair of scissors and cut them right in half. And the reason is that when a plant's under stress, it does what's called transpiration, which is like the plant sweating. So it's taking up water and it's expiring it. It transpires the water into the air. It's like you sweating, like I said. And when you reduce that transpiration, the plant is able to then focus more energy on the rooting, which is what you're trying to get done. That, those leaves will grow back for you. You want some on there. It has to be able to photosynthesize a little bit, but you don't want like big, giant, bushy topside. Little bee stem down, that's going to kill the plant every time. Rosemary, really easy. And rosemary is going to be somewhere between that softwood, hardwood category, but you can do the same thing. And rosemary, another fantastic herb, and usually available fresh, and oregano. And oregano is a perennial, so is rosemary. Anything that's a perennial is generally fairly easy, right? Generally fairly, like a drug commercial, right? Generally, there is hope, right? But generally fairly easy to root as a softwood, especially herbs and shrubs. As you move into trees, which you don't get from supermarkets and we're not talking about today, that can be some easy, some hard, and some need something like intermittent mist to do well. Regrowing cores. Of course, celery we already talked about and pulling that outside off, but there's several other things to do really well regrowing from cores. And those include leaf lettuces. So I don't know why anybody eats iceberg lettuce in the first place, the head lettuce. It's got no flavor. It's got no nutritional value. It tastes like water. So I probably wouldn't grow in the first place, but it doesn't really work well as a regrowth. But any of your leaf lettuces, your romaines, your tower lettuces and things like that, they do really well regrown from cores. And again, all you do is pull your outer leaves off. And the more you leave of the core when you root it, the better it will do. And they work so well, kept in moist soil alone, they will usually root for you. Because usually as you pull those outer things off, you end up with a little bit longer of a stem. And good, high-quality, organic, moist soil in contact with that stem, you know, like artificial light, like plant light or something like that, or window light, usually enough to keep the plant going for a bit until it starts to root. Or you can root it in water, and they do fantastic in ebb and flow aquaponics or hydroponics beds. I mean, absolutely fantastic. And the more of the center you leave, the better the plant will do and the faster it will begin to rebuild. So I've literally bought things like a head of lettuce like that, ate half of it, put the other half of it in there. I see that as storage. I'd rather store it alive than in my refrigerator dying. If it's living, it's not dying. If it's living and it's continuing to grow, it's as fresh as it can be. I can almost refreshen it that way. So that's a really good way to go with that. I do that with a lot of things too, like green onions. If we have to buy green onions, which we almost never do anymore, but if we do, I use what I have to use, regrow the tips. We'll talk about that in a second. All the other ones, just hold, maybe cut the little bit of dead off the end of them, stick them right in one of the aquaponics beds. If I need them, they're out there and they're alive. They're not dying in the produce drawer in the bottom of the refrigerator turning brown and slimy. See how simple that is? So it's kind of like storage on the go, right? The celery, I think I covered that pretty well. Bok choy. Bok choy does really well as well. And another one out of that is cabbages. And if you do, they all are done the same way. Now the cabbage, here's a hack on the cabbage. What you can eventually do when you begin to get some, you'll see the stem start to grow a little bit. And you have this kind of like trying to regrow cabbage head. As long as you got to have good roots when you do this. And this is something you can do if you grow cabbage in your garden from seed or whatever. Anyway, you can still do this. When you cut the head off the cabbage, leave a good piece of stem above ground on the stem, okay? Take your knife and cut a cross. Go right through the center and then through the center. So you make it into four quadrants and cut down about, you know, an inch and a half inch to an inch into the stem. This is going to freak you out if you don't know this. Each piece of that stem will start to grow, and it'll grow 4 small cabbage heads. How cool is that? And again, you can do that from a grocery store regrown core with some success. Or if you're growing cabbage from seed, I guarantee you it'll work. And then another thing you can do with a lot of this stuff is just grow babies. Grow babies out. So you can go buy like baby bok choy and stuff like that and just root it and make it into a full-size plant. On the lettuce, a lot of places sell, like they call them living heads. And I'll tell you what these are like usually like a butter leaf lettuce or something like that. They're hydroponic. And they've turned that opportunity into a selling point. And this is for multiple reasons. The plant will stay healthier this way, but it also drives home that this was literally harvested and sent to you as soon as possible. So they have these lettuce plants growing in a hydro system. So that means growing with water and fertilizer only. And when they harvest that, instead of having to cut anything, they just go lift that head up out of whatever it's in. Like an NFT system would be basically like a pipe with water running through it, and it's sitting in a hole in a little basket cup. They pull that out, and they pack it with the roots on. And they take it, and they put it in a clear clamshell, the roots in the bottom with a little bit of water, and close that up. And that is going to have a much longer shelf life as a fresh product than if they didn't do that. Well, same thing. You pull all that off. Now it's already rooted. You just plant it. And that works really well. Or things like baby beets. Like sometimes when you go to the market, they have little bitty baby beets. They're, you know, like the size of a cherry tomato. If you plant those, and we'll talk about doing it just for greens later, but if you plant those, not only do you get greens off them, eventually there'll be a full-size beet you can harvest. So now you didn't really grow it from leftovers. What you did is you took something that was, you know, the size of a grape, and you turned it into a full-size beet. With red beets and whatever, I can see why you're like, what's the point? But like golden beets are delicious, and they're a little more finicky when it comes to starting from seed. So this is a thing that you can – I want you to think about it this way, because, again, we're going to talk about greens next, but we take these little baby beets. Maybe we buy a couple bundles of them. We use some of them right away, the biggest ones. We take all the little ones. We cut the green off the top, right, and we put them not all the way to the base. We leave a few inches there, and we put them into whatever we're going to put them into. They can go into an aquaponic system, a hydroponic system. They can go right in the soil. They just need to be well-watered in the beginning. And they start to regrow. Now they start to regrow. We have a green we can harvest, but that root is going to get bigger. And so we can end up with a huge beet at the end of the season that's 4 to 5 times the food that it was in the early season when we bought it. And it's almost like a guaranteed shortcut. It will work. It will grow. It's not going to die on you that way. It's not going to be hard to germinate. And you can plant it at times of the year when seed may not germinate as well. So that's another good one. Now, when we talk about growing things for secondary products, beets come back. Beets for greens, carrots for tops, leeks, green onions, and what I call fiddly garlics. And the fiddly garlics can be grown into brand new garlics, by the way, but they can also be grown for the greens. So the carrot, I think I covered already. You know, leave yourself half an inch to an inch of the top of that carrot, and you're going to get much better results. That tuber that you eat, the part you eat, that's what the leaf is depending on. That's an energy reserve. It's a symbiotic relationship. The leafy matter, right, is doing photosynthesis to make energy for the roots, but the root is storing reserve energy for the top of the plant. It's a battery. The green is the generator. The root is the battery. So the root is a surplus of energy. So when we now commit surgery, radical surgery, amputating 50% of your body would qualify, right? There's more battery for those greens to regrow from. And you have a little bit more base, and you might get some funky looking kind of cool carroty type thing at the end of the season, but you're getting those greens. On the beets, kind of just covered that, leeks, green onions, and fiddly garlic. So leeks and green onions are back to the same piece of advice. Instead of just cutting that little tip off the green onion, leave about an inch down there. Take those. You can stick those in a glass of water and change it every couple of days until new growth comes out of it. Throw them out in the garden. That's all it takes. I put mine in my ebb and flow beds, because which is for aquaponics, because it's just so friggin' easy. Just straight in they go. Like I said, I'll even, when I have to buy a bunch for a workshop or something, I'll throw them in there, even if I don't use them, like whole, just because now they're stored. They're just going to get bigger and stay fresh. And then on leeks, you know, with leeks, they're a fantastic regrow crop. They will actually grow a pretty good, completely reusable leek for you, or you can take just the tops off them. But I'm back to leave yourself, with leeks, I'd say about 3/4 inch. So from where the hair roots are up the shaft, about 3/4 inch, and it'll regrow for you, no problem. And those can be just directly planted out, or they can go into some others like water or what have you. Then the next is creating slips and clones. I really only do this or have experience doing this with two items right now. I'm trying a third, and it's turmeric. And turmeric, I know you can just plant it, and it's supposed to grow. I don't know if I'll be able to pull slips off turmerics or just make the roots more effective, or if the turmeric I got is got retardant on it, so it has retarded growth and it won't grow. We'll see. I have not had them pop for me yet this year, but that's something you'd probably want to go to when you're doing this. If you can get an organic product, you want an organic product because you know it doesn't have a chemical retardant on it. But ginger is one that people buy all the time, and they plant it and they get more ginger. What they don't understand is you could have a piece of ginger, maybe a third the size of your hand, and you might be able to produce 5, 8, even 10 ginger plants off of it. The best way to do this, number one, is if you're if you have a really big piece of ginger and you're going to cut it. I said this recently on a different episode. Wherever you cut it, set it out and let it dry and let that cut scab over. When you touch it, there should be no moisture. It should be dry and rough. You know, it should feel a little bit like a fine sandpaper. No moisture at all. Dry, scabbed. If you don't do that, planting it, rooting it, doing anything with it, there's a very big potential. Just like your body, if you have a wound and you don't use any sort of an antibiotic and you don't protect it and you don't cover it, you can get an infection. So you get microorganisms and bacteria inside the root, which is really a chrome or a tuber, and it starts to rot, and all of a sudden it gets squishy, and then when you squish it, it smells really bad. I don't know if there's many things that stink worse than rotted ginger that are not, you know, like an excrement thing. That's how nasty it is. So you don't want that to happen. So let them scab over. Sweet potatoes, don't cut them, leave them whole. And all we're going to do is either put them in water, and the best way, I've seen sweet potato where people take it and they put toothpicks in it, and they put it in the top of the jar, whatever. You just take a pan, fill it with water about an inch deep, and lay it on its side in there. Change the water every day, or every other day with a sweet potato, honest. With ginger, usually the best course of action is just to plant it, but if you want to do the slip thing, this is where it's worth having ebb and flow beds. So an ebb and flow bed, again, is a system on a pump, and the water fills the bed and then drains the bed and fills the bed and then drains the bed. And we'll have a substance in there like lava rock or leica. And leica is really good for this type of stuff because it's not sharp. It's like little marbles of puffed clay. And you take your ginger root and you don't do vertical, which everybody kind of wants to do. Ginger kind of looks like a hand, so it's flat. And look for your little nodules on it. Put it just under. If you can just kind of sort of see the top of the root, it really likes that. The light helps stimulate germination. And a few days to a couple weeks into it, you'll see all the little nodules. Some of them will start to swell and turn white. And eventually they'll start to push little roots out, and then they'll kind of nodulate. They'll fatten up. Like they'll get the size of like a really big pea or maybe a bean and turn into like this white round marble shape. And they'll start shooting up a green shoot. When that green shoot gets a few inches tall, you can break it off that ginger just like a slip off a sweet potato and either plant it in the soil or move it to by itself into your ebb and flow bed if you're doing that. And as it starts to grow, eventually you put it out in the garden, it'll produce a whole new ginger plant. And that way, again, that one piece of root might make you 4 or 5 or 6 plants instead of making one. And it's just an interesting way to go with it. You can do it either way. When you do sweet potato, like I said, I kind of did a whole show on that. But the beauty with sweet potato is, I mean, the amount of slips that you can get off of one tuber is huge. I've got right now off of one plant in one of my ebb and flow beds, I think I counted yesterday, it's 26 slips, and it's making more. 26, and it's making more. And once you have a few slips, guys, dead easy. You let the slip get really tall, and you cut it in half and stick it back in and make another one. Sweet potato roots is the slips part, the green growth. Those vines root as easily as mint. It's stupid easy to do. So even if you get a sweet potato and you only get four or five good slips out of it, you can still plant a whole garden of sweet potatoes because you just keep rerooting. The other thing you do with sweet potato, this is outside of garden or outside of supermarket reproduction or whatever. You have a nice long sweet potato vine. You dig a hole in your garden and pull some leaves off that vine, leave it together, stick it into the ground. Okay. Cover it up and make sure you keep that spot really, really well watered. Wait about 2 weeks, and the mother vine that's coming in versus the daughter vine that's coming out, just cut the mother vine off, and it'll start regrowing its own world, and that'll create a new root base. And you might think, well, what's the point of that? Well, the point of it is that sweet potatoes, generally, wherever you plant that slip, it's going to make sweet potatoes there. It'll make 4 to 8 of them, depending on the variety and everything else. But all that vineage doesn't make any more sweet potatoes. But when you create a new root zone, you create another place for tubers to form. So you can do that over and over and over again. It's one of the most productive crops in the world, really, for a calorie crop. Next, though, is direct planting of all or part of the plant. I didn't talk about garlic real quick, the fiddly garlic. I left that out for you. The fiddly garlic up in the growing for the upper part. When you buy garlic or you even harvest garlic of your own, you're going to find when you take that bulb and break it apart, start separating the cloves out of the paper, toward the center, you're going to have like 4 or 5 that are little tiny thin pieces of crap, and they're just not worth smashing with a knife and trying to get the garlic out of them, so most people throw them away. If you stick them in, especially an ebb and flow bed in an aquaponic system, they'll grow 6 inches tall in about a week in an ebb and flow bed. They go crazy. You take those tops and cut them off, use them like chives. That's all I mean by fiddly garlic. If you plant those in your garden, they can produce new garlic, but you're given a little battery there. And so the time of that planting needs to be around mid-September to have garlic like next October, November, because it's going to have to take that long. So you need a long growing season if you're going to start with those little bitty cloves. But the flavor bang out of using those greens is huge, and it'll probably regrow about 10 times and just grow one straight tall green, almost like a green onion, but it's a garlic. It'll probably do that about 10 times before it's like, I give up, boss. I'm quitting out. I'm dying, because you've drained that little battery of all that it had. So that's more like a garnish or really good on potatoes, things like that. Any place where you'd want fresh garlic flavor without the heavy garlic bite of fresh garlic that you haven't cooked yet. All right, direct planting. Again, we did the ginger, the sweet potato. Turmeric, I have had no success with this, but my understanding is even though the plant kind of grows also like a hand with big fingers, but think of a vertical hand. So now when you pull that root out, you have like almost like a like the udder of a cow, right, or something like that, with just tons of udders coming down in, that when you plant it, you're better off planting it sideways. About a half of an inch deep, that's all you have to do with ginger. If you get the non-retarded ginger, right, you want something that was organic, and you're going to get a much better result on planting. But it grows a huge, it almost kind of looks like a elephant ear. And the only thing you need to know about them is that you need a fairly long growing season. So if you're in more northern climates, you may want to start them in pots indoors. But you can definitely buy turmeric, organic turmeric, at even the high foofy foo falutin foodie grocery store for less than you can buy the exact same thing from a place that sells plants. You know, they're going to charge you $5 for one piece of it. You go buy, you know, a pound of it for $8 at Central Market. So, and it's a great spice seasoning, call it what you want to, herb, many medicinal uses, and a pretty unique flavor, and something that we in America don't utilize as much as places in the world where it grows natively. Potatoes are the easy button, especially any kind of organic potato. What you do is you let them sit out until they start to form eyes, which is like your little nodules coming out of them. If you're cleaning potatoes, you usually cut the eyes off of them. and cut them into pieces, making sure each piece of the potato has at least one or two eyes. Let them scab over. That just simply means give them a few days until when you touch the exposed part, the non-peel part, it's completely dry and kind of rough, and plant them and grow them like regular potatoes, because that's all seed potato is. When you go buy the little bag of like four little eyed potatoes and a little, you know, like lunch bag from the 80s, right, at the feed store, and that little bag is like $6, $8, and it's got like four potatoes in it, that if you went to the most expensive grocery store, it would cost you like $2 at the most. It's the same thing. It's the same thing. In fact, some of those people might be buying their potatoes like that, repackaging them as seed potatoes and putting them out. So potatoes are another huge caloric crop. Most people like them. They're not the easiest thing to grow in the South down here. We do much better with sweet potato, but in your more north, like northeastern, like Tennessee North, et cetera, fantastic crop to grow. Fantastic crop to grow. Now let's talk a little bit about a plant that's widely overlooked, and I don't know why anybody would buy it for cultivation anywhere than the grocery store and buy it organic. Horseradish. Horseradish, and most people I find in America today have no idea what horseradish is. They think it's kind of like wasabi in a way, in that people think wasabi is what it is when it's really horseradish dyed green with maybe some mustard added to it, and that's not really wasabi. So horseradish, most people think of horseradish, they think of a white, mayonnaise-like, thin sauce with a little bit of a heat to it. And what that is mayonnaise with a little bit of horseradish in it. That's not horseradish. Horseradish is you take the horseradish root, you peel it, and you fine grate it, and that's horseradish. And you can make it into something more like you're accustomed to. You can look up recipes for it online. But it will actually be good. It will actually be worth eating. And if you like pungent, spicy heat, but you don't like persistent pungent, spicy heat, like a pepper, then you might find that you love horseradish used in certain ways. And what I mean by that is if you eat even something relatively low on the hot pepper scale, but you have low tolerance of it, like a serrano or even a jalapeno, raw, if it's too hot for you, you have a problem. You can drink milk, you can eat bread, you can do all this in water and stand on your head, and it's going to burn for a while. No matter what you do, it's going to burn for a while. When you eat horseradish, if you eat way too much of it for your taste, and it like punches you in the mouth, in 5 seconds, it's gone. So it's a very useful plant. All you have to do is take a piece of it and stick it in the ground, it'll grow. My grandmother was huge on horseradish. I have a big affiliation for it. And I also like it with the juice from pickled red beets mixed into that's Ukrainian horseradish. There's no creaminess at all, right? You take the grated root and you have, maybe like a handful sized bit of it, because a little goes a long way, in a bowl. And you take about a tablespoon of pickled beet juice and mix it together. That's it. And we take kielbasa, which is a Polish smoked sausage, in slices, and put little dabs of that on it. Freaking fantastic. And every fall, when she wanted to take all of the horseradish that we had before winter came, I would go down to the patch and dig a bunch of it up. I'd bring it up to her. She'd leave about an inch and a half of the tops on it, put them in a bucket, say, go put them back where you found them. I remember one time, this would have been about 1984, I guess, somewhere in that range. No, it would have been more like 85, 86, somewhere in that range. She had me do that, and I asked her, I said, Grandma, how long have you been growing that same horseradish root? And she said, I'm not sure, but we put that patch in before the war. And she wasn't talking about Korea or Vietnam. She's talking about World War II. So in about mid-80s, that had been producing for at least 40 years. Nobody ever did anything to it, and you too can establish your own horseradish patch just using cut pieces from the grocery store. It's as easy to propagate as comfrey. Now, I have one thing to warn you about when it comes to horseradish. You are not going to want to eat the leaves, and you're going to feel the leaves, and they're rough like sandpaper. It's horseradish, and you're going to be like, well, Another's going to want that. Well, maybe a horse or a cow would eat that because it's called horseradish. So, okay, yeah, sure. My ducks aren't going to eat this. My chickens aren't going to eat this. My geese aren't going to eat bullshit. They will. I made the mistake of trying to establish a patch where the birds could get to it. I'm like, what eats? Why is it gone? Because pests really leave it alone. And the few things that will nibble on it, they'll never eat enough to kill it because it just regrows from the root. And I finally caught the geese. And then I started watching, and the geese, the ducks, and the chickens all ate the tops of the horseradish. Plants everywhere, and they something about it, they really like it. There must be something to it nutritionally that they crave because they would eat it with things that I thought were a lot more palatable around it. And they say that animals are wise enough to medicate themselves on what they eat, which sometimes is true and sometimes results in them killing themselves. Like when my quail in her aviary decided they were going to eat deadly nightshade and hallucinated and literally several of them hung themselves in the aviary. A different day for a story. All right, from seed. I want to give you from seed. If you know how to plant seed, you know how to plant seed, right? But there are some things you need to know, and there's some ones that are particularly fun or interesting to do from grocery stores. One is peppers, especially unique chili peppers. Like if you happen on, you know, especially like I said, the foodie grocery stores, you happen on like a really cool chili pepper, and it just because it says what it is, like grocery stores just want to sell it to you. They put any name on it you want. Like if they could do this, it would be like Jack's Happy Chili Pepper. I mean, that's all they're doing. Sometimes it's legit, sometimes it's not, but what strain of Serrano or whatever, you know? So when you find a good pepper, all you really have to do with peppers is when you cut them open, take the seeds out, let them dry, and plant them. That's it. But one thing I found that makes explosive baby pepper plants, and I found it totally by accident on one of those, I wonder what would happen if I did this thing. So when I cut a pepper, I take the pepper and I set it down on its base and I cut all four sides off of it and it leaves a core. And then usually there's a little bit of pepper on the bottom and I'll take that off. And then you end up with this core with all the pith and the seeds, very little to wash out of the part you use. And you got this core. So I always throw those cores into my compost. And that could either be the compost out by the birds or the worm bin. Well, what I started noticing is a lot of times when you throw those peppers in there, you go in there and pull up your cover to add some more stuff, and like there's a billion sprouted pepper seeds, except they're really long and leggy and busted and white and unhappy because they were in total darkness. So I was like, self, what would happen if you checked on them every day and when they just started sprouting, you planted those? Would it be different than dry? And the answer is yes. Because the fungal and bacterial relationships that they form inside that worm bin are making me wonder about doing it with some other seeds to see what happens. And it is different even than putting a little, like I like to do this too. And I'm starting my seeds. I'm giving away some secrets today. I'm starting my seeds and I make that little hole to drop the seed in. I don't cover it with the potting soil. I'll have a little cup full of worm castings, nice wet, gooey worm castings, fresh out of the farm sitting here. And I'll put a little, that's what I cover the seed with, to form those bacterial and fungal associations with the roots of the plant on germination. But something about them being in that active bin, and I'm planning on playing with this and seeing what happens if you do it, seems to create a much faster growth. So some stuff that might be a little sluggish or whatever coming from seed like that takes off. And that was just, I wonder, and I'm like, next time I do it, I'll check every day until I see, you know, the little rootlet coming out. Now it's time to go and take a little bit of the worm castings with it. Tomatoes, you never know what you're going to find in some of these foodie grocery stores. And I want to talk great. Here's what I want to talk about with the tomatoes, peppers, eggplants, everything. You take seeds from cucumber. It's a hybrid seed. It's not going to be edible. Shut up. That's not how nature works. I have never planted a seed from any fruiting plant that did not produce an edible fruit in the next generation. It might not be the same. Sometimes it reverts to one side or other of the hybridization. Sometimes it goes kind of a different way. Sometimes it literally is the same. And to understand this, you need to understand what a hybrid is and what it isn't. It is not a GMO. GMO, one category, hybrid another category. Now, you might have a seed that is the result of a hybrid and GMO engineering, but they're not synonymous. All a hybrid is variety A and variety B cross-pollinated and made variety C. And the reason that people do this is it's called hybrid vigor. And when you create a hybrid plant, usually you get a more robust, faster growing, larger plant than either of the mother plants. And there's nothing wrong with it. It does make saving seed for repeatable results a little bit more complicated. But when you're getting the seed for free and growing a couple of them to see what happens and deciding if you want to make it part of your life or not, why do you care? Okay. The other side of this is every heirloom started out as a hybrid. Every heirloom starts out as a hybrid. That's how it works. Except for the few plants that we grow in their wild form. Orich, some amaranths, which even those are, the Incas did it 1,000 years ago, right? Like somebody made selected choices in regrowing things, and there was cross-pollination. And the way you make an heirloom from a hybrid is you grow 20 plants. And you take, then you look for one or two of those 20 to produce exactly what the mother plant looked like. Same size fruit, same thickness of wall of the pepper, whatever it is. Same coloration, same leaf form. And when you identify that these are the, then you take those and you take seed from those. And you plant 20, 30, 40 of them again. And you do the same process. And now you're going to find out if 20, you know, 4, 6 of them produce through your tribe. Then you're going to harvest from those and you're going to do it again. And eventually you're going to get to where like 100%, and it's usually about seven generations in a vegetative species, a fruiting plant, you'll get to where you stabilize those genetics. And now you have a new heirloom. So who knows what you'll find or create by taking this path. That's another reason this is fun to do. Melons of all kinds. Most melons, whether they're hybrids or not, are going to produce something that looks just like the mother plant. The cross-pollination! Stop it. It's possible. But when you go to a grocery store and you buy a particular type of melon, understand that that plant grew in a field acres and acres and acres of the same thing. Monocropping for good. Okay, monocropping for the wind for once. Like when you buy like a certain kind of watermelon, it grew surrounded by mostly watermelons that look just like it. Farmers don't grow row one, watermelon A, row two, watermelon B. Even if they do, like if you're really a full-on watermelon farmer, right, and you want to spread out your seasons, you have like A in a huge plot and then B and then C. And sure, they might overlap pollination a little bit, but it's more likely that they won't. And here's another thing, just a gardening thing. For those of you that are retarded about the whole cross-pollination, watermelon, or squashes or any of these types of cucurbits and what all, and it's going to make a Franken squash or a Franken melon or whatever. No, it's not. Not this year. Yes, if you get two watermelons of different species and they're planted next to each other and they cross-pollinate, you are going to end up with a hybrid. But the fruit you get, right, it's not going to be a hybrid itself. It's going to be exact, like if you plant a watermelon and something weird comes out, you had a messed up plant, messed up nutrients or something like that, or the seed itself was an unintentional hybrid seed. Same with a squash, same with any of these things. Because let me explain to you how to think about a hybrid. Think about like dogs and crossbreeding dogs. And again, every breed of dog we have, other than like dingoes, you know, that you go back to a true wild form dog, we created them. And we created them through selective breeding and hybridization. So a very well-known hybrid dog that has not really become its own breed now and been stabilized would be like a Shepherd Collie mix, right? Great dog. And you take a mama collie and a daddy shepherd and you put them together at the right time and nature takes its course. And the shepherd and mommy make a baby shepherd collie. And when you look at the baby, it looks like it has characteristics of mom and dad, okay? When these plants that people worry about, this Franken squash or Franken melon happening, You look at their flowers, and their flowers are sexually specific. In other words, there's a male and female flower, where some plants have perfect flowers, meaning they have male and female parts in the same flower, and the flower can literally pollinate itself. Peppers do this, right? They're perfect flowers. Tomatoes do this. Even if a bee just gets on that one flower and moves around, it'll jostle some of the pollen onto the stamen inside the same. It doesn't have to go one to the next. It'll reproduce. A squash can't do that. Pollen or a melon, pollen from the male must get to the female, and you can identify the female because it'll have little melon even before the flower opens. You can look at that one's female, and then one will have a stem and just a flower, and that's male. Okay, so there's your male flower is your German Shepherd, right? And your female flower is your collie dog. So then one thing leads to another, and the birds and the bees hum, okay? And you get a baby, but the baby is the seed. You understand that? The melon that grows that season, or the squash that grows that season, or the cucumber that grows that season, any of those types of plants that grows that season, that's the collie dog mom. So when the shepherd has baby puppies with the collie doesn't turn into a shepherd collie, her puppies are. That's your squashes, your melons, and everything else. And that's something I always need to explain. Then tropical and unique fruits. You know, you can grow dragon's fruit and stuff like that. And, you know, I'll just say this. Whenever you go to grow something like that, and you're like, I don't know if it's worth the time. First of all, it didn't cost anything. It's fun. You learn something. But I'm also for learning from people who already learned. So you could, how long does it take for this thing to grow from seed to a mature plant? How big is the plant at that time? And what are its environmental requirements? And you might find, well, I can plant this in January indoors, and I can keep it out. Like in April, I can roll the pot outside, so put it on casters, and it will grow outside all the way until fall. And when it gets cold, I can bring it back in, and I can put it back out in spring again, and then I'll get something. And you decide if you want to or not, if it's that elaborate. A lot of these things, you might just have to plant them like around Thanksgiving, and kind of baby them, but then in spring you put them out and you get production that year. It's all up to you. Some of them are going to be perennial, and you might bring them in and out. So there's all kinds of unique tropical fruits you can try doing stuff like this with. Just find out what they are, and you know, always ask yourself, I'm gonna make that one a question, Jesse. Remember, guys, if you have questions, put the word question all caps. But that's a good question. Because I'm actually working on doing that. I'm working on doing that, Jesse. And we'll talk about that in a minute. But just use AI and say, you know, tell me about this particular plant. How big is the plant when it produces? How long does it take to produce? What is its climatic requirements? And decide if you want to make the effort or not. Somebody earlier asked about pineapple. Yeah, you can grow pineapple. It's a real pain in the ass to get a pineapple. Unless you live where they grow outside year-round, like South Florida, it's a real pain in the ass. If you live in a place where they grow outside year-round, I would totally learn how to propagate pineapple. And there's multiple ways to do it. It can literally be done through these little tiny seeds in the pineapple itself, or it can be done by regrowing the top and then doing some other things to get it to produce. The thing about a pineapple is that plant will basically produce once before you kind of have to reboot it. And it is complex, but if you live somewhere where they grow outside, what a fantastic plant to grow, you know. And then squash and pumpkins. Think about the variety of what you see show up as table decor every fall around Thanksgiving time, Halloween, Thanksgiving, through that period of time. Lots of stuff there. Now, one of the things to know is this is going to work much better with a winter squash. If you go buy zucchini or yellow squash or something like that and try to grow it, it's not going to do well. And it's not going to do well because the seeds aren't fully mature. If you're going to try to do it with something like a cucumber, you want the biggest cucumbers they have for that type, and you can try, but the seeds are often not fully mature. Because though, like a zucchini, a yellow squash, a cucumber, if you're saving it from your garden from seed, you want to let it to grow past the point where it's really palatable to you, till it fully matures, and then harvest seed. And you can look up how to do that online if you've never done it before. But your winter squashes, your butternuts, and all your turban squashes, all those, you know, shelf stable, does not require refrigeration stuff, all of that can be regrown. And everything I said about the melons and the puppy dogs and everything applies to them as well. You can be terrified of them, or you can have some fun and you can grow some cool stuff. Here's some some stuff I want to refresh you with before we wrap up and take some questions. Some like hacks and trick methods. Again, the ebb and flow. If I decided I never really wanted to mess with aquaponics again as a full-on production system, I would still have that 55-gallon fish tank in my garage and those two 7-gallon grow beds with that recycling pump doing ebb and flow. Just for clones, just for rooting clones, just for making sweet potato slips, just for regrowing fiddly garlic. It is the easiest set and forget it thing you can do. I mean, literally, I go out and take the thing I want to root and stick it in there and walk away. And it's because it's aquaponics, and you could do this hydro as well, but because you're on a system like that, it has to be automated. You can't forget to water it. All you have to do is keep an eye on your reserve tank, and when the water level gets low, refill it. That's the totality of it. And aquaponics is kind of a specialized fiddly expert task, right? It takes a little bit of time to learn how to do right. If you're growing for production, for the shit we're talking about today, throw five feeder goldfish in a tank and go on and feed them flake food and go on with your life. Everything will be fine. If your feeder goldfish dies, bury it in the garden and go buy another one for 15 cents down at PetSmart. I mean, that easy. You don't want to even pay for the fish. Go to the park pond with your kids. Take some worms down there with you. Catch four or five little bluegill. Throw them in the tank. When one kills another one because they're assholes to each other, go get another one and let them freaking fight it out until you have king bluegill in your tank, right? And then eat him and get five more new babies. Like, you don't need pH testing. You don't need nutrient level testing. You don't need any of that shit. If you're just rooting cuttings and things like that with aquaponics, you could do this so, so easily. I'm going to be doing some aquaponics hacks as an episode in the near future. I'm going to talk about some things I've discovered that you can do with aquaponics systems that literally nobody else is doing. But that's coming soon. Next is using that rooting box I talked about. I'm going to try to get that done this week. I got a lot of shit going on, some final things with the tax stuff and all. I don't know if I'll get it this week, if not next week, but really look up rooting box on YouTube. You'll find what I'm talking about. Again, just a Sterilite, and that either a pump doing circulation or an air pump. And it will improve your rooting success rate like mad, because oxygen to the root zone is everything, more important than anything else. And then, again, putting those pepper cores in the worm bin, I'm wondering what else can happen with that. I've even thought about, like, you know, one of the ways that I'll root hard, or I'll start hard to start seeds that you plant, you get low germination rate. I'll take like four or five layers of paper towel and wet it and wring it out so it's just damp. I'll lay those seeds on, I'll fold that over, I'll put a Ziploc bag on it, and then I'll put that up on like the cable TV box and check it every day. And when you start to see a little rootlets come out, plant them. And that's been a really cool hack for some seeds that are a little bit fiddly about starting. I've thought about doing that, but then not putting it in the bag and just setting that in the worm bin under the cover, but on the surface, so that all that wormness because this is getting a little bit advanced and it's not really on point for today's subject. But one of the things you need to understand about why some people have these gardens that just explode with growth, and they, you know, their fertilizer is they throw a few handfuls of compost whenever they set out a plant and they grow a cover crop and that's it. And they don't ever buy any chemicals and they don't buy anything and everything just grows. And you think, man, they must have the most fertile soil in the world. They do, but it's a lot like your soil. Your soil is just dead. It's all about the biology in the soil. And when a plant has its seed germinate and that little rootlet comes out into the soil, the first thing it's doing in its little plant life is seeking a association with certain soil fungi and bacteria. And it's really looking for mycorrhizal fungi. And the earlier it forms the associations, the stronger the associations will become. And the more living the soil is, the more exchange will happen in the exudate process and other things like that with the plant and the soil organisms, and the stronger and healthier the plant will be. And that's why some people have these gardens like, it's right across the street from you, and then explodes. Sometimes it's just that person's been doing it longer, but it's not the experience. You could be doing the same thing, just they have developed the biology of their soil and not destroyed it through practices like tilling for a lot longer of a period of time. They have a more mature system, not necessarily just a more educated gardener. When I first came here, I had to start with nothing. I knew what I was doing, but I had to start with nothing in an area with denuded, dead everything. And so now what we do today is amazing, but it took time even for me. So just know that. That's a little extra thing right there. Let's go ahead and take some questions here. I have four. If you have a question and you don't see your question show up, now would be the time to re-ask it. I'm just going to real quick before I answer them, I'm going to go through each question one at a time. So if you think you asked me a question or made a comment, see if you come up. I feel like remember the thing with Romper Room? I see Debbie and Susie, right? Some of you are not old enough to know what I'm talking about. But if you don't see your question appear on the screen in the next couple seconds, and there'd be the last one, I don't have your question. So you need to re-ask it now. This is last call for questions and comments. So this one is from Plumber Mickey. On a recent show, you had grow lights as item of the day. Where do I find that listing? Bigger garden this year, and I'm short on grow lights. Poor choices at local stores. The lights I use are made by a company called Barina. But if you look at the form factor of them and like they're out of stock and something you want and somebody else has the ones that look the same, there's like 20 companies that are making the exact same lights. Barina, just good company, stands by their product, fixes shit if it's broken, and has the best price. That's why I recommend them. But they're called Barina. You can just go to the survivalpodcast.com and there's a search box. Put lights in there and you'll find it. Or put grow lights in there. I'd say put Barina in there, but you'll probably spell it wrong, right? And you can always go to tspaz.com. And on the page that you'll get to, if you go to tspaz.com, you'll see all these categories like gardening, right, or lights. And you click on one of those, and that will narrow down because there's like 400 reviews. That'll narrow you down to a dozen or so. You can just scroll, and you'll find the lights. And since I ran them recently, you'll find them pretty quick. But Barina Grow Lights, just put Grow Lights in the search box, and you'll find them. And, hey, you know, thanks for bringing that up. If you shop starting at T-Spaz, no matter what you buy, you help my show and the work that we do here. So if you need any, if you can't find it for any reason, dude, email me, jack@thesurvivalpodcast.com, TSPC in the subject line, and let me know, and I'll send you a direct link for those. But they are fantastic. Question from Vincent Loonman. Okay, flat farmer. Have you tried using lentils for root propagation? I'm going to try a mix of lentils and willow leaves. I don't know what you mean, lentils. Willow works really good as a natural rooting enhancer. And I'll tell you the best thing with willow this time of year is find your new tips that are just starting to bud out, cut those off and macerate that up, add a little bit of water to it, and put that on whatever you're trying to root. It definitely works. Lentils, in my head, when I say lentils, I'm hearing lentils, which are like a legume. It's like a dried bean product, basically, even though they're not a bean. If that's not what you mean, let me know. I'll have to look that up after the show. Sometimes I don't know everything, and I don't know about that one. But the little powdered rooting hormone thing, like I said, unless you're making 10,000 plants, $7. As long as just don't get it on yourself is all I'm going to say. And that little bit will do everything for you. But lentils, I'm going to have to look that up. Question for anybody. I have to leave town for a pretty substantial amount of time. I need to come up with a reliable drip system off my barrel if anybody has congestion or somewhere to look. I think he means a suggestion somewhere. I'm not sure. The only thing about that barrel only has so much water in it. So if you're dripping 10 gallons a day, 5 days on a 50-gallon barrel is about all you get. So, but most drip will, like standard drip line, will work just with volumetric pressure. But that's not something I really do. The only drip I've ever run off of something like a reserve tank is a 2,500 gallon poly tank, and two of them plumbed together, so 5,000 gallons of volumetric pressure. And I've seen it done with standard solenoid to open and close, standard drip line, and 300 gallon IBCs. So that and really almost no elevation. Like the IBCs were sitting on like one stack of cinder blocks. So that'll work. And then Jesse C says, spicy bell peppers? Yes. This is something I've played around with, but I've never taken seriously enough to do because it requires a little, let's call it flower surgery. So because the pepper plant is a perfect flower, you have to literally take the blossom apart before it opens in a specific way. And then you can collect pollen from one to take to the other. And you isolate the pollen that would self-pollinate so it doesn't self-pollinate, because you have to be sure that A pollinated B. And what people do when they're doing this, to be sure, since you're having to do this surgery on both sides, right, is you do an A to B and a B to A. And then you tag those stems. And then to really kind of make sure you get really good results, now that you've tagged that stem, usually you got peppers kind of in the same area, then your baby peppers that are going to kind of compete on that spot on the plant with your tagged stems, you take them off early so all the energy can go to growing that new pollinated hybrid. Remember, the pepper on the California bell is going to be a California bell pepper. It's the baby. It's the seed that is the hybrid. That's where the shepherd collie is. And so you could do something like a standard sweet bell pepper and bring pollen from a jalapeno to it. And then that should have some characteristics of both as a baby hybrid. And then you can do that whole process. If you decide, like, I love this, you create a new heirloom. You can also back cross. So if you go jalapeno to bell, right, and you get kind of stuff like a smaller, more productive bell pepper, it's got a little hint of heat in it, but you want a little bit more, you can then the next season take the plant that you grew when you went sweet pepper to jalapeno. Now you get a bigger, less hot jalapeno, but it's got jalapeno genetics in it. Now you can take that, grow out a new generation, and then back pollinate it to the bell and keep working on that bell pepper form and bringing the heat up. And there's a sweet pepper called bullnose that has a little tiny hint of heat. That's exactly how that was made. But if you wanted to make a spicy bell pepper, okay, you might want to go up the Scoville chain, and then you can selectively breed to retain the heat, but the bell pepper form with the daughter generation of plants off that F1 generation. There's a lot of fun you can get. This is not a show on genetics, even though we talked about it a little bit, but there's a lot of fun you can have playing with that. Jesse also said, I had spicy bell peppers for years, plants from a different source. Does that mean my plants were contaminated? Because I always thought they were crossed and made them spicy. If you weren't saving seed, then I don't know if contaminated is the word is, but they were what they were. You are not going to have a California Wonder red bell sitting next to a jalapeno get cross-pollination this season and have the fruit of this season show any characteristics of the cross-pollination. On any plant, anywhere, at all, infinity, that does not happen. Again, that would be like you take a daddy German Shepherd and you breed it to a beautiful female Border Collie, and the female Border Collie turns into a half-shepherd. That's what would... Just genetically, that's how that works. So either the source seed you got wasn't what you thought it was. I love that. Plumber Mickey says, comment, Jack doesn't know everything. I'm devastated now. I'm going to tell you who likes it when I don't know something is my wife. Especially if she knows it and I know it. She's like, yes, I got one. It's a fun relationship. All right, the mic went mute there for a second, but we got it back. I enjoyed doing today's show. I want to start trying to do at least once every other week a show more like this, one that's just all fun, all useful, little bit of laughs here and there. Nothing serious, nothing heavy, no talks about bombs falling down or tornadoes hitting your house or any of that stuff. Just stuff like this that makes your life a little bit better, teaches you something, and lets you enjoy yourself. Or thanks for tuning in today. Pretty damn good turnout in the live stream. Not like when I do a show about the end of the world as we know it with, like, you know, 500, 1,000 people, but, you know, 130 at the peak. That's pretty damn good for a show on just gardening from the grocery store. As we wrap up today, I want to remind you guys that you can help support this show, as I said earlier, by doing your shopping, starting at a place called tspaz.com. How can you forget tspaz? If you're Gen X, come on, Spaz, tspaz, you got to remember it. So tspaz.com is where you can find all my product recommendations. My product recommendation today is not a gardening or plant propagation recommendation, though I guess it could take some temperatures on some things if you wanted to. It is the Thermal Maven Instant Read Meat Thermometer. If you like to cook, and I do, especially if you cook meat, you need one of these, because this is not only how you make sure your meat is safe, because that's the least of my worries, honestly, guys. If chicken's undercooked, I'm going to know it. I'm going to be upset, but I'm not going to eat it. But what I don't want is overcooked. And that is the chief reason you need a good meat thermometer. So as you think you're getting close, you're taking that temperature. So when it's at the temp that you need to pull your product for your preference, you pull it then, let carryover heat do the rest. And that way you don't have a, you know, you don't go out and, my wife and I just ate two beautiful ribeyes last night. They were two of the best steaks I've eaten in a very long time. They cost us $20 a piece. I don't mind paying for it once in a while. I don't want to pay for it and then have shoe leather. And so, you know, I pulled my steak at like 132. I pulled her steak at 140. Hurts my heart a little bit, but I do it. But I don't want that thing hitting 155. It's going to be ass. You wasted all your money. This thermometer is like $20, and it saves you from ruining things or eating something that's going to make you sick if you're worried about that. But I want to tell you what I love about it, okay? As what it, 'cause we all know we need one, right? Why this one? First of all, most of the damn things use like the little round watch bat, like the big watch battery style batteries that you use in like a thermal scope or something like that. And they're fine for what they are. There's nothing wrong with them, except when you put one in one of these, I don't know what it is about the people that make the damn things, but you have to have a freaking degree in engineering to change the battery. It never wants to go back together. And when you get it back together, if you do it right, it works, but it's a pain in the ass. And, you know, you're sitting there, dude, it doesn't work. This, you take one screw out, pop out a AAA battery, stick it in, put the screw back in. It takes less time to do it than it just took me to say it. So that's one good thing. Two, accurate as shit. This thing is accurate can be. There's no calibration, no work to do. It comes and it just works. And I'm telling you, when it says that that meat's 136 degrees, that meat looks like it's supposed to at 136 degrees. You can trust it. The next thing I like about it is most of the meat thermometers like this, they kind of open like a folding knife. I don't know why. It's not that complicated to do, but they don't have an auto off. That means you forget to close it, and you will. Ask me how I know. And you leave it sit on the counter, and you come back to use it again, and the battery's dead. This one, after like a minute of unuse, it shuts itself off and doesn't kill the battery. And it'll even open a beer for you. See the hole in the back? That opens, you know, any kind of bottle that needs a bottle opener versus a twist off. So it'll do that. And it's got a magnet on the back. So when you're done using it, throw it on the side of the grill, on the side of the refrigerator, the side of the stove, whatever, and it'll be there when you go get it. So why would you buy any other meat thermometer? And if you don't have a meat thermometer in your kitchen, I don't usually say this, but you are wrong, because you need one. If you're a vegetarian, you don't need one. You're going to be miserable anyway. Go ahead and be miserable. Anyway, with that, guys, I appreciate you tuning in today. I really enjoy doing the show on a fun subject. If you have a subject kind of like this, maybe not even about plants or gardening, but something that might be like fun like this, something maybe lots of people do content on, but nobody really explains it in a way that actually makes it practical, let me know, and I'll think about doing it. Tomorrow, Wednesday, time for a guest show. Not this week. Just Jack shows for you all week long this week. I don't know what the hell we're going to do. As tomorrow right now. I'll have to figure it out between now and then, but I'll find something good to talk about. I mean, if I've done it 3,813 times, I can probably do it one more. Take care, guys. Jesse says you should do an auction, two tickets a year for the meetup. I guess he means my fall workshop. So if I did an auction for him, they'd probably sell for more because it would be a guaranteed seat because it always sells out. I like the way you think. I don't know if I want to do that to people or not. When I first read it, I thought you said raffle. Why would I raffle something that sells out in minutes? But an auction, that's an interesting idea. I do not hate money. Maybe what I could do is this. What if I did an auction? We picked a charity, a good one, not one that like 95% of the money goes to the CEO's, you know, private jet or whatever. And we said the spread goes to charity. So tickets, what, $650? And if the auction tickets went for like $900 each, it'd be $500 goes to charity. And I don't take the overage. Even though I said I don't hate money, I don't think that's not hating money. I think that's, you know, being responsible with your influence and giving back a little bit. So maybe we'll do something like that. I'll kick that around. It's another logistical thing I have to do, right? Anyway, guys, take care. I'll catch you tomorrow with another episode.
They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.